This is an ABC podcast.
Hafa day, kia ora koutou, and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the show, we'll cross to Samoa shortly to get the latest on its political instability. Our concerns over a presidential pardon for a convicted paedophile in Timor-Leste. And how about that game last night? New South Wales taking out round one for the State of Origin series. More on those stories shortly, but I'm your host Aggie Tubo, and we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, you're tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We head to Samoa first, where Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa is staying tight-lipped about whether she'll form a new party to contest the upcoming snap election or run as an independent. Months of instability and infighting between Fiamme and members of her fast party came to a climax on Tuesday when Parliament failed to pass the national budget. Because of that, Samoa's head of state has said Parliament will be officially dissolved on the 3rd of June, which means a snap election has to be held within the next 90 days. That doesn't leave much time, so Fiamme says the judiciary will be asked for its opinion on how preparations for the election should proceed.
There are certain legal issues in the Electoral Act that will require guidance from the judiciary pertaining to timeframes required for the registration of candidates and voters. This will ensure clarity and legal compliance of all arrangements for the general elections. Priority will be also given to ensuring that the machinery of government continues to function with due consideration of the use of public funds. There are constitutional provisions governing the use of public funds by a caretaker government.
And that's Samoa's Prime Minister, Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, speaking at a press conference late yesterday. She was also asked about her plans for the future and whether she'd be contesting the snap election, and if so, how, following the dramatic split in the FAST party in the last few months. Well, our reporter Adele Fruin was there, and she joins us now this morning. Then I say, Malole Soifua, Adele, thank you for joining us.
Malole, Aggie, how are you?
I am good, thank you. Well, look, I know a lot is happening there, back in the homeland, and the question is, what did Fiamme have to say about her participation in the upcoming election?
Yes, thank you. Now, Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa did confirm that she'll be running in the upcoming election, but she did refrain from confirming if she will join a new political party or whether she will lead it. But she did hint to expect an announcement possibly next week after Parliament is dissolved. Then maybe we'll find out then if she will join a party or not.
Well, Adele, did Fiamme at least expand on why the judiciary will be asked about the preparations for the election?
Yes, as she stated in her speech, you know, there are certain legal issues in the Electoral Act that require guidance from the judiciary. This is pertaining to the timeframes, you know, because right now, because, you know, Parliament will be dissolved and expectant to have the elections within a 3-month period. But right now, you know, 52% of voter registration has been completed. We are looking at over 200,000 people overall that has to be re-registered before the election. And then you've got, under the law, it requires for 6 months of, you know, for all candidates to register, you know, before an actual election. So these were some of the factors that led to Prime Minister and her cabinet needing, you know, that clarification and guidance from judiciary, you know, in order to interpret the law properly, so that to ensure there is clarity and legal compliance.
Of course. Yeah. Okay, so well, given the split in the FAST party, I know some people were wondering, you know, who the caretaker government will be after Parliament's dissolution. So did Fiamme address that issue?
Yes. Fiamme confirmed that Cabinet will continue the administration. You know, they will be the caretaker government until the first session of the Legislative Assembly. This is also following the dissolution. Now, this is all in accordance with Articles 32 and 33 of Samoa's Constitution. So even though there was an attempt She did also confirm that, you know, there was an attempt of, you know, the legislative clerk, you know, writing a report to the head of state stating there would be a different, you know, a different team or so, for example, the other side, or because it's the fast, you know, party altogether, the government. But, you know, they wanted the other side to be the caretaker because they have the majority. However, under the law, it's the current cabinet and also the prime minister that has to be the caretaker government.
And did she, if you knew Adele, if she had said anything about whether or not she was able to sum up this term of government?
Oh, yes. You know, she laughed about it while talking, you know, about that. But, you know, overall, she described it as, you know, it felt like she was going through a storm, basically. That's how she, you know, described the experience of this term, you know. And she said the transition itself of a new government coming into power and ending a 40-year power, basically, you know, especially, you know, with the previous government being in power for so many years, you know, it was not easy at all. Now, while reminiscing about the history of Samoa's parliament, she recalled there were instances in, like, you know, like the political situation Samoa's currently in now, where members of parliament changed alliances. So it's not new to her, as she recalled, you know, but overall the experience was like a storm, as she would say, while laughing it off. But yeah.
But what about her opponents then? Have they made any public statements?
Okay, so far, former Prime Minister Tula Epa, who's also the leader of the opposition, you know, said straight after, I think, or after, you know, Parliament session, said, you know, it was a mistake for the Fast Party to be the government, you know, in the first place. You know, it was his opinion about the situation. And he was saying this is evident to the fact that they did not even complete their 5-year term in power. He even went on to say their party or the, you know, or the Human Rights Protection Party advised Prime Minister Fiamir to resign from office because it was a more dignified way compared to being voted out with a no confidence vote. However, you know, Prime Minister Fiamir did stand her ground and chose not to resign. Now, as for the Fast Party chairman and leader, Laauli Lewitish-Schmidt, you know, his party members have been gathering to pray, basically. You know, they haven't issued any statement or fronting the media. Maybe because right now there's an ongoing case that involves the Fast Party leader. Hence why they're refraining from, you know, going on social media. But, you know, right now it's just prayers and gathering, for now.
Well, Adele, as we wrap up, you know, what about the public, though? You know, what are our people saying about this week's events?
Right now, you know, it's everybody, I think the majority feeling right now for most people, they're just shocked. Even though this started from the beginning of the year, we were expecting the fall of government to happen in the beginning of the year, basically. You know, everybody was expecting for that to happen, but it didn't, you know. And so right now, it came as a shock for some members of the public. And they're just like, oh my gosh, like, is this really happening? Is our government coming to an end? Is Parliament really dissolving? You know, and then for some, they were just like, oh my gosh, that was very fast. It happened so fast, really, because it just started off opening prayer, a few words, speeches, and out of nowhere, there was a vote to pass the first reading of the bill in Parliament. That failed. And then here we are waiting for an early election. You know, for some, it's surreal, honestly. Mm. And then, you know, most people are relieved, though, because this was the solution most members of the public shared that they wanted. You know, this is what they wanted, because finally, you know, Parliament is dissolved. This will, you know, this will allow all members of Parliament to go back to their constituency, you know, because they will be the ones. The people will choose who the leaders will be, so, you know, in the upcoming election.
Well, look, there's still so much more to unpack from this situation in Samoa. But as always, Adele, whaftaitele, love for your time this morning.
Thank you, Aggie. Have a lovely day.
You too. That is our reporter, Adele Fruin, live there from Samoa.
It's one of the biggest rivalries in rugby league. The State of Origin series between New South Wales and Queensland. Thursday from 7 p.m. PNG time, tune in for all the action from the 2025 Women's State of Origin. Who will take home bragging rights? New South Wales and Queensland. Live from 7 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Malo Dalma Ebongbongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Eggy DeBall. Now, the life of Australia's largest oil and gas project will be extended to 2070, with Australian Environment Minister Murray Watt giving the long-awaited environmental approval for the North West Shelf project to be extended beyond 2030. Woodside proposed the life extension to its West Australian gas facility 6 years ago, and it has sat under assessment since then. On Tuesday, Tuvalu's Climate Minister, Mai Natalia, said the North West Shelf extension would lock in emissions until 2070, threatening our survival and undermine Australia's chances at hosting the next global climate conference in 2026, in partnership with Pacific Nations. But recently, Vanuatu's Climate Change Minister, Ralph Regan-Vanu, had this to say about the project.
We have continued to make it very clear to Australia that we expect them to stop approving any new oil and gas projects.
Lucy Cooper spoke to Dr. Wesley Morgan, a fellow at the Climate Council.
Australia has told Pacific Island countries that Australia will work with them to shift away from coal, oil and gas. And this is what's needed to ensure the survival of Pacific Island countries. So, you know, either fossil fuels will survive beyond 2050, or Pacific Island countries will. And this decision really undercuts that idea that Australia is working with the Pacific to ensure the survival of island nations.
What does it signal about Labor's approach to climate?
Well, what it says is that the federal government in Australia is getting on with the energy transition at home. So we're shifting away from coal-fired power to wind, solar and storage. But the federal government continues to approve new coal and gas projects for export and is not prepared to do anything to limit that those fossil fuel exports. The trouble is that Australia's fossil fuel exports over the next 5 years will be more than three times greater than all of the emissions from, the emissions from those exports will be three times greater than all of the emissions from Australia's domestic economy. So this is just untenable, right, to be shifting to wind, solar and storage at home while approving coal and gas for export.
What message does this send to Pacific politicians like Tuvalu's climate minister, who only this week vocalised his opposition to the project?
Yes, so Tuvalu this week has said that approving this extension of this massive gas project would threaten the survival of Tuvalu and would violate the spirit of cooperation between Australia and the Pacific. You know, this isn't a short-term political decision. This is about the moral dimensions of the relationship between Australia and the Pacific. And what the message it sends is that Australia does not yet care enough about Pacific Island countries to work with them to ensure their survival.
And Australia has a bid in to host COP, and that would be in partnership with the Pacific. The Vanuatu's climate minister said that if Australia would like to host COP with the Pacific Island nations, they would hope that it would mean that they would approve no further oil and gas projects or extend them. But we've seen that happen today. Do you think that this will maybe make the relationship tenser, or, you know, even threaten the Pacific support of Australia hosting COP in the next few years?
Look, Pacific leaders have been clear that they want to host the UN climate talks with Australia. So the Palau president, Sarungal Whips, the Vanuatu climate minister, Ralph Regan-Vanu, they have said that it would be a good thing as an opportunity to tell the world what needs to happen for shifting away from coal, oil and gas and to clean energy as fast as possible. So I think they would be telling the Australian government that this is a devastating and disappointing decision, and really it should be a line in the sand that if Australia wants to host the UN climate talks with the Pacific and cement the relationship by working together with island nations to address their key security threat, then Australia will need to end the approval of these massive new carbon bombs, these massive new coal and gas projects.
And that was Dr. Wesley Morgan, a fellow at the Climate Council here on Pacific Beat. To Timor-Leste, President José Ramos Horta says a meeting with the survivors of convicted paedophile Richard Dashbucks did not influence his decision not to grant the American a presidential pardon. The former Catholic priest, who is serving 12 years in prison for sexually abusing young Timorese girls, had been nominated by the government for a presidential pardon. But Ramos Horta told a press conference in Delhi that his decision was not influenced by public sentiment or the voices of survivors.
The government, usually they would send from the Ministério de Justiça long list with different recommendations. But I focus on what I believe, because I also have the names. People go to Pecora, go to Bledo, go to Suai, to check, listen to Director Regional, listen to Ministério de Justiça. Then the only names that I had and agreed were these six. Yeah, I listened to some, but mostly the victims, that to see how to help them more, to the victims in terms of jobs, in terms of education. Then when I meet with them, I don't want to hear their stories, because the stories are in the report. I don't want to start asking questions. I'm not a PGR, I'm not a police, you know, I'm not, I just say what you need. So I try to help them.
As a civil society organization, FOCUPERS would like to express our sincere appreciation to His Excellency Mr. President for his strong commitment to uphold the rule of law and for showing sensitive in ensuring justice for women and girls who are victims of sexual abuse, especially children. This also tells the world and the decision of not grant the clemency to the abusers. This is also tell the world that our justice system support the victims, and that crimes like sexual violence and child abuse must be punished. We must continue working as a civil society, FOCUPERS, and other civil society. We must continue working hard to prevent abuse and protect our children in our future. Especially as a FOCUPERS, we remind bold in our mission to protect women and girls who are victims of abuse and to promote their right, so they can live free from any form of violence. We will continue to stand beside them, raise their voices, and advocate for justice on their behalf.
Do you think you have a lot of many other cases regarding to the sexual abuse case that happening in Timor, especially pedophilia, that happened to the children in Timor?
Based on our experience, we have some victims who stay in a safe house. We recognize that deal with the victims of sexual abuse, we take long time how to recuperate them from their trauma. This is a long process.
Did you worry about the next year if there might be another pardon proposal for Richard Dasbach from the government? My last question is about, did you worry about the next year if there might be another proposal from the government to give pardons to the Richard Dasbach?
As I said before, we are stand beside them, especially the victims. Even in a future that might be happen, as a civil society, we strong to advocate it through the justice system, and also to raise awareness. State itself, the president, might be stand in their position that justice for victims should be number one.
And that is Domingas Afonso Amaral, Executive Director of Women's Organisation for Coopers, sharing her thoughts about the situation with our ABC reporter Vonya Vieira in Timor. Pacific Beat. Wow, New South Wales has defeated Queensland in the State of Origin opener 18-6 with a spectacular performance. After tough opening exchanges, including a scuffle 2 minutes in, the Blues burst out to a 14-0 lead on the back of two tries, two backs from Zach Lomax and one to Brian To'o in the space of 10 minutes. The Maroons managed one try in the second half, but it just wasn't enough as the Blues controlled the contest. So, on the line with us to give her analysis is Melanie Kawa, a former Melbourne Rebels player and former captain of the Papua New Guinea's Sevens team. With that, I say good morning, Melanie. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Aggie. Pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, yeah, especially this early. And of course, you know, with what happened last night, I have to start off, you know, New South Wales. Seems like they had a pretty easy first half. What went wrong for Queensland?
You know, it was a very interesting match, wasn't it? Anyone who's a Blues, been a Blues supporter like I have my whole life.
You and me
never
both.
You never like being at Suncorp for a decider because, you know, game one is so critical. Mm. But what a fantastic performance. The Blues actually looked so polished, just like they did coming off their series win last year. It really feels like they've just kept the same sort of group together and playing with really huge confidence there. And it was a really intense first 20 minutes. And I just think the only difference that was between the Maroons and the Blues was the Blues sort of had this cooler head. You know, there were some uncharacteristic penalties coming from the Maroons that, you know, just really felt like they were a bit more nervous and a bit more pressure to be at Suncorp in game one. But outstanding finishes from the likes of, as you mentioned, Lomax and then, you know, the fight back was always there. You can absolutely never discount the Maroons from anything. So even with the 2 points added right before halftime, I thought, oh, gosh, it could be one of those thrillers in the second half. But, yeah, just cooler heads, better decision-making, and it just looks like the Maroons have to regroup. But they're going to neutral ground for game two, so it could set up to be a really good series as well.
Yeah, well, you know, the score could probably have been much worse for the Blues because, I mean, wasn't too sure about Nathan Cleary. He had missed three conversions. Not too sure. What did you think was going on there?
My heart was in my mouth as well. I thought, oh, no, this is setting up to be a fairy tale. And there was a set of defensive 15 tackles by the Maroons where I thought, oh no, this is their turning point. They're going to shut New South Wales out from scoring even more points and then they're going to go down the other end and do it. But yeah, as you said, it was just uncharacteristic. Some of the passes didn't go to hand. I thought some of the game management, the referee was being extremely strict from the outset, and I think that sort of maybe got, again, under the skin of some of the players from the Maroon side as well. So look, it was just a game of inches and miracle passes that just happened to pop out the back for the Blues and things like that. So it sort of tipped the favour that way. But look, the talent across both sides, just you really are looking at some of like the biggest and brightest stars, and perhaps some of them even brand new to Origin, like 19-year-old Maroons Toya, who I thought had a brilliant debut at 19. You know, you forget how young they're blooding all these NRL players these days. But, yeah, still really exciting, especially if you're a Blues supporter. So there's going to be a few more jerseys around this morning, I think.
And look, and that's it. Many Blues fans also were surprised that Jerome Luai was being left out of the Blues squad. I mean, you know, he played a key role, I would say, in last year's Origin. Were you surprised, though, that he wasn't picked for this round?
Absolutely, myself included. I was looking for him and I'm thinking, yeah, I didn't hear about him in the lead-up. I think, you know, you'd have to think that there's a reason there, some personal reasons maybe, or he's just wanting to focus on his club footy or something. But there was that, you know, I thought To'o had an amazing game. And just that entire, that Cleary to Moses to Latrell Mitchell, who I thought had a brilliant game. I mean, considering all the baggage and things that come with him around origin selection. I thought he's looking so fit. He's playing absolutely brilliant this season, and I thought he was a real key factor in the Blues win last night as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, Melanie, I want to talk about the fact that there's, you know, there is a number of Tongan and Samoan internationals on the field. Questions were raised last year about whether representatives of non-Australian teams should actually be allowed to compete in the tournament. I mean, do you have a take on this? What's your thoughts?
Look, yeah, I know I did hear that argument sort of raise its head, and it has its reasons too, because if you can imagine what a representative side from Pacifica or Samoan Tongan, they feature so heavily in the Origin, and you'd think it's about time, you know, imagine watching them sort of focus their efforts on their national heritage and playing countries, what that would do for the game. And we see it in the likes of rugby with Moana Pacifica now, you know, on the birth of reaching the top six, and that initiative to just allow players, and I'm talking the highest of high-profile players like Adi Savia, go back and lead and see what that's doing, you know, for them personally and just for the game in general. It's absolutely wonderful. But, yeah, look, if you were to take out, you wouldn't really have an Origin series. I mean, man of the match last night for Blues was,
right,
was nice. Payne Haas.
Yes.
You know, he has Samoan heritage. Mm. And a try scorer for the Maroons is my fellow countryman Xavier Coates as well. So,
yes. Yeah,
there's a lot of high-profile people. And I just would hope that they are allowed to, express themselves and play rugby league wherever they feel comfortable, especially for their home nation. So,
but
we love seeing them play.
And I do want to switch away from, you know, the men's team now to, you know, our women's. We can't forget about the fact that tonight is the women's finale, right, of their State of Origin. So I'm just wondering, look, the series is currently tied 1-1. Who do you think are the favourites going in?
So I think New South Wales, definitely. I think they may have won the first, and there might be a dead grubber tonight, but the women's are just going from strength to strength to strength. The amount of eyes watching this game now, and I'm not just talking, women's eyes watching sport for the first time. I'm talking it is such an excellent contest that needs to be put in stadiums to actually fit the number of fans that are coming to watch the Origin. It's the same spectacle. So that brilliant contest that we all love for Origin is just, it's indistinguishable now, that feeling of seeing the women play. And they should be put on that sort of pedestal, on that sort of platform that they deserve. And I think they're just going strength to strength. But New South Wales,
there must be
something going on there. Yeah.
Well, you know,
they're looking favourites for me.
That's it. But you talk about, you know, so many eyes on this, on the women's team, because I think the attendance record was set a few weeks ago with nearly over 26,000 who turned out to the Suncorp Stadium, which is such an achievement. But why then do you really think overall is women's rugby league becoming so popular?
Look, there is a lot of factors. You know, there's some growth standards and development standards that I think league identified really, really early in that, you know, something like a quarter of the playing participation was there, but hardly any of the marketing and anything else was there. So you could see that if you just grow and invested in those right areas, women's sport as a global brand in general is one of the fastest growing brands in the world. So by identifying that and just by having great development and club grassroots rugby league, and making sure like good local comps are across the country, and especially these high performance feeder comps as well for young girls, just giving them pathways and avenues to sort of play rugby league, I think that's something that's really working. But above all, I think it's the way they demonstrate in the media that they appreciate women's sport. And I know it's a constant battle, so you're not ever there yet and shouldn't be satisfied and stuff like that. But the way they promote the game of Origin, for example, and the way you employ full-time women in the NRLW, and that is attracting not only local talent, but international talent. So now you've got sevens players from rugby all over New Zealand, as well as, overseas internationally, Canadians, Americans.
Yeah.
They're now looking to come and play in such a premier comp. So there's so many factors supporting women in rugby league at the moment. But, yeah, I think other sports especially can take a lesson from.
Yeah, which is a great positive thing to hear for a woman. I do want to sort of roll back because I know we had just touched on it a little bit when I was saying, you know, there's Tongan Samoan internationals on the field. But this, again, State of Origin itself, it's been called an Australian sporting event. But again, it has a strong following in New Zealand and even the Pacific Islands. Why do you think the event has attracted such a strong following?
You know, and I can speak for one example of in Papua New Guinea. So when, you know, it used to be an Australian colony, and I think the Queenslanders especially brought the game up there and just started playing it locally. And I think there's certainly an element around the physicality of league, the nature of tackling and that sort of collision sport. It's something that brings out the energy in your body and things like that. But it is a very good and nice and easy game to support and watch. I've got my partner who sort of didn't follow rugby or league from Melbourne until we met, and then now he actually can understand it a lot better because things around the game and the way that they make something sort of have to happen every, you know, set of six. So it's almost like you're looking for results and stuff like that. So there's something that's just a consistent entertainment to watch and enjoy. But the physicality, I mean, that's probably one of the key factors in the game.
Oh, goodness. Look, before we wrap up, I do want to just ask, you know, going into the second game, or you know, where do you think, because we saw New South Wales take out the first round, where do you think, though, Queensland has to improve?
You know what? This feels really weird to be in this position talking about it. But as I said, it's neutral ground over there. So I don't know who the West Australians really support. They might be favouring one side over the other. But, you know, if they've got, you know, they'll go back and the likes of the key playmakers like the Munsters and the Harry Grants, and they'll sort something out. Honestly, you never put them wrong. So, you know, if they use their aerial game a tiny bit more. I thought they were quite unlucky not to get that try just before halftime with the send-off of Coates. Yeah. So, they keep pulling from their strings. Although it was funny because the Maroons is full of Melbourne Storm supporters, my team, and I seen Bellamy in the Blues box. So I'm thinking, uh-oh, he's given all the tips away.
It was a great game, though. But look, Melanie, that's all the time we have for this morning. Great to catch up with you. I'm sure once it comes to round two, round three, look, I'm sure we will be bleeding blue.
Yeah, it's always the way. Thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is Melanie Kawa, former Melbourne Rebels player and former captain of the Papua New Guinea's Sevens team here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month in the United States this week. It recognises the contributions of Asian American and Pacific individuals who have made contributions to the American society in areas like science, government, the arts, business and civil rights. It's marked by events throughout the country, and ABC's Finel Fonua spoke to one event organiser in Salt Lake City, Susie Fauch-Malohi-Fo'ou. She is the CEO at Utah's Pacific Island Knowledge to Action Resources.
There were lots of things that were organized. I mean, this week, Sa'ili, which is a Samoan community group, they have some people from the Hukulea, from some of the Vakas here doing a whole weekend, a week of education. A lot of the Asian community, we did a 5K together. And a lot of the Asian communities do events. The whole month has been full of events. And on even like the Native Hawaiians, you know, was here from Hawaii, and she also did some education and workshops. So the month has been full of culture for both Asians and Pacific Islanders here. We have about 80,000 Pacific Islanders that live in Utah.
Is events like this, is having heritage months like this important? What's the purpose of events like this?
I think for visibility, to see us, because we live in a place where we're now small in numbers and people just don't see us. And so they have a Hispanic Heritage Month, they have, you know, Black History Month. And so it's just a way for visibility and to showcase our own culture. So we have two Pacific Island charter schools here in Utah. We have Mana Academy and we have Pacific Heritage Academy. And both of them would celebrate. The like mainstream schools may or may not do anything. Nationally, in Washington, D.C., all of the national Asian American Pacific Island organizations have events in Washington, D.C., and we'll do hill visits. There'll be galas. There's a lot that goes on in Washington, D.C. around Asian American Pacific Island Heritage Month. Mm-hmm. And I know it's strange for people not in America, right? Because I've had this conversation with people that are from New Zealand and Australia, and they ask me, what is this? And I always say, it's because you come from a place where Pacific Islanders are the mainstream, right? New Zealand, the Maoris are the indigenous. In Australia, the indigenous are the Aborigines. And we are not the indigenous here in this country.
I see.
But I know a lot of people outside of America, it's hard for them to understand why are Asians and Pacific Islanders put together.
A lot of people would be surprised that Utah has a sizable Pacific Islander diaspora there. It's landlocked in the Western United States. How did Pacific Islanders end up in a desert state like Utah?
It's because of the Mormons, the LDS Church, that did a lot of missionary work in the South Pacific. And so then how the Native Hawaiians came here, and they were the first people here. So one of the presidents of the Mormon Church had gone to Hawaii, and when he came back, he asked some of the Native Hawaiians to come here. And they ran into some racism, and then the church moved them out into the desert and gave them a big piece of land, but it was in the middle of the desert. And the Hawaiians moved out there and made it into a very beautiful city. And they even won an award back in the 1800s for the most beautiful city in Utah. Once the LDS Church announced that they were going to build a temple in La'e, Hawaii, then most of the Hawaiians moved back to Hawaii. But there were still some that stayed here that were married to, say, Samoans and other Pacific Islands. And then it started from there.
And that was Susie Fauch, Malohi for All, CEO at Utah's Pacific Island Knowledge to Action Resources. And back to sport now. In Papua New Guinea, the village of Hanuabada on the fringes of Port Moresby is regarded as the hub of the cricketing world. Over many years, it's produced a long line of national team players, men and women, but it hasn't always been that way. Turn the clock back a few decades and PNG's second city lay was at the top of the tree. And now, as Richard Ewart reports, with men's cricket in particular heading towards a tough period of transition, Cricket PNG is keen to revitalise the game in Lae and grow the game in the Highland Provinces as they seek out the best new talent.
The president of the Lae Cricket Association is Ken Ela, and he says the shift away from cricket in that part of PNG has a lot to do with demographics.
A lot of Papuans, those of us who come from the Moresby area, play this sport as much as everybody else does. And in the past, when they were either based in Lae or in the Highlands, they would go out of the way and ensure that cricket was played. Hence the reason why we used to hear a lot of them in the 60s, 70s, 80s, in the yesteryears, but we don't as much as we used to now, because those people have since either either move back home or they're deceased.
But now Cricket PNG are working on a new strategy with a particular focus on the provinces. Development manager Hena Samwell says playing numbers are up in schools and there are 11 established regional centres. But when it comes to high performance, the capital still holds sway.
I think it's obvious that most of our players are based in Port Moresby and Central Province because that is where cricket is most popular. But with our existing programs running in other regions, I would love to improve the quality of the game up there and also refine our pathways so they can have access to our national teams in the future.
If Ken Ila had one cricketing wish, it would be to see a proper turf wicket laid, but he acknowledges that would not be an easy task.
I think having a turf wicket in lay would be great. However, the association or Cricket PNG would need to own that land for starters or lease it or something. Right now, we're actually leasing the cement pitches we use for cricket here off institutions. I know it would be a huge boost for our players because, you know, we get to know how to play on turf cricket.
And now Samwell is all too familiar with the land issue, but she's urging Lay's cricket fraternity to be patient because she's as keen as anyone to install that turf wicket.
I'm glad that you're saying this because I was just preparing for this interview and I had this in my heart that the next thing that I would like to do in terms of facility was to get turf existing in Lay. Definitely, it's also part of my plan. Not only turf, but for other regions, we'd love to do indoor nets to increase players. But Lay is definitely a good start. The land issue is everywhere. So that's one of our challenges that we're currently facing. And yeah, definitely it will be our priority for development side of things. And we can work with Ken to get that wish list come true, yeah, hopefully in the next 5 years.
Bigger and better facilities in Lay would have a knock-on effect for cricketers in the Highlands because the city is reachable, and right now, that's where they head to play.
Cricket PNG has development offices up there. It's just, especially in the Highlands, we'd like to see facilities for games to be played. I think only Goroka has a pitch or two up there. In the last 5 years, maybe we've had the kids come down from the Highlands to actually participate in tournaments down here in Lay. And I know that cricket is still alive, but not as good as what it used to be. We'd like to see more emphasis put back here in Lay, which is closer to the Highlands and accessible by road. It'd make it easier on the Highlanders and places like Madang to come down and enjoy a bit of what Moresby does.
Cricket in PNG would appear to be on the brink of a watershed moment with many of the senior men's players approaching the end of their careers. And with the under-19s performing poorly at the recent World Cup qualifier in Japan, there are concerns over a talent gap, and that's where the provinces could come into their own.
That's why I'm putting my focus around pathways initiatives. Most of our players come from the cricket-playing villages and communities, whereas other provinces do not have the chance. So that's something that we would like to work around, refine our pathways and get that gap filled in so we could have a better team in the future.
Right now, there is a handful of players from the Lay area in the Laywers squad, but quick bowler Damien Ravu is the only player in the Barramundi's camp. Times have certainly changed.
Our fathers and our uncles and people who played in the past made it big time and they dominated representative spots both in the junior divisions and also the senior national sides.
Why do you think that balance has shifted? What has changed? Because certainly if you talk to people about cricket in Papua New Guinea, Hannu Abado is always mentioned. It's where all the talent is. And yet clearly from what you're saying, historically, that's not necessarily the case.
At this point in time, maybe the Hannu Abadans do dominate, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's always been their place. What I can say, though, is that I'll take my hats off to them. They've actually maintained their love for the game and done something about it, as opposed to everybody else who's backed off a bit.
And even though there is a wider representation in the women's teams, Hena Samwell would like to see that grow even more.
We still need to have a representation from other provinces. We used to have a program called the Girls Empowerment Cricket focused on increasing female participation, but the program was inactive for the past years due to challenges. So my plan is now to revive that program so we keep the moment and maintain our female participation.
And that is Hena Samwell, Development Manager for Cricket PNG, a job that she just took on just 3 months ago, and the reporter there was Richard Ewart. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Samoa's Prime Minister Whiamea Naomi Mataafa is tight-lipped about whether she'll form a new party to contest the upcoming snap election. We heard from our correspondent in Samoa.
It came as a shock for some members of the public, and they're just like, oh my gosh,
like, is this really happening? Is our government coming to an end? Is Parliament really dissolving?
Find that story when you type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back at same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.